She smiled slightly, and her hands moved up to rub across her braid. I thought you knew. You always seemed to know what everyone around you was thinking and feeling, but you did not return my admiration, so I kept it to myself. I have more pride than some. You say long ago. I was angry with you for a long time, Kaer. Perhaps I will come to love you again. I will need to escape these lands. Shlara will know I aided you. Our eyes met, and I sighed. I loved Shlara. I love this elven woman. I have loved you like I imagine a brother loves a sister, but I can't return the feelings you have for me. I knew my words would disappoint her, but I had caused too many problems by hiding my feelings. I know. Perhaps your feelings can change, as I predict mine will. She crossed her arms. Do you want my help? I love her, I said without hesitation. I cannot leave her. Then you will watch her die, and then be tortured by Shlara, or you can live with me. My mind scrambled. Perhaps there was a way I could convince Alexia to assist me in rescuing Iola Rothi. It was unlikely, but I would not give up Iola Rothi. If the elven woman truly loves you, she would want you to accept my offer. I need time. There is no time, Kaer. You must leave now. Can you help me free her? I should have thought of a more eloquent way to beg. No, I am unable to free her. She shook her head, and a hint of anger entered her voice. I doubt that. Fine. I don't want to. You no longer command me, Kaer. This is a gift I give to you, and it means I'll be betraying my friends as well. If you... Her voice cut off suddenly as footsteps sounded down the hallway. Several sets of footsteps. Oh my! Am I interrupting something? Shlara said, once she yanked the door to my cell open. Alexia crossed her arms and stood to the side so that the burned woman could enter. Now that the door was opened, I could smell the stench of her burnt flesh. Behind Shlara stood Malik, along with six guards. Well? Shlara shifted her gaze back and forth between the blonde woman and I. Her green eyes never blinked in the torchlight, and their dilated pupils enhanced my perception of her madness. Alexia shrugged and crossed her arms. I was surprised that she was able to maintain her usual calm exterior. Malik looked between me and Alexia. It was clear from his expression he understood exactly what was happening. So did Shlara. Well, then... I am glad I arrived before you two decided to do something stupid. She giggled a bit, and then it turned into a hysterical laugh that made her bend over in the melted armor while she clutched her stomach. While she cackled, my body broke out into a cold sweat, and my heart began to race. Fuck me. I should have escaped when I had the chance. I'll deal with you later. Shlara's laugh ended suddenly as she seethed the words to Alexia, then spun around to the guards. Malik took a nearly imperceptible step backward when Shlara turned to him, his fear clear in the reflexive movement and his startled facial expression. Bring him to the courtyard. She gestured to me and then walked out of the cell, confident they would obey. The guards rushed into the room after she exited and wrestled me into new manacles and shackles. I fought against them, as I had the other times they had tried to move me, but I was no match for six of my empowered kin. I was forced to my feet and dragged behind Shlara, Malik, and Alexia out of the dungeon. The courtyard had changed since I rescued Iola Rothi. The stables and feed house had been torn down. In their place, a wooden set of seats were arranged around the inner walls, similar to the kind the elvens built for their musical or theatrical performances. I remembered the ruined city Iolorothi had taken me to. There had been a similar amphitheater there, constructed of stone. This theater was quickly filling with humans. The seats were already half full, and a stream of bodies was snaking its way into the courtyard. I estimated they could cram 10,000 people into the makeshift stadium. In the center, where a stage should have been, a steel cross was driven into the ground, surrounded by cords of firewood. Malik motioned to the guards, and they dragged me toward the cross and set me down in the sand. Shlara was not here. Malik, Alexia, and the guards flanked me, and thousands of O'Barney and humans surrounded us. I could not even fathom escape. Alexia noticed me looking around and shot me a quick glare. The look communicated her frustration in an instant. I also sensed her fear. Not only was I trapped here, so was she. I had ruined both of our chances for freedom from Shlara. With or without me, she could have escaped in the confusion of trackers attempting to find me. But now that Shlara knew she had tried to aid me, Alexia was in danger. I closed my eyes and sighed against the ocean's roar of the gathering crowd. I could not waste my time worrying about what Shlara would do to my generals after I was dead. Gorbani and Thayer were seated prominently in the front row opposite the pyre. Their expressions were dark. This was necessary, but they would not enjoy it. Malik glanced nervously over his shoulder toward the dungeon. I turned my head to see if he was looking at Shlara, but the moment I shifted my neck, one of the guards slammed his fist into the side of my face. The blow was as strong and shocking as if a horse had kicked me in the skull. My ears rang, and I tasted blood in my mouth. "Face the fucking front," he growled. "Fuck you," I spat blood and a molar out onto the sand. "Stop," Alexia's command froze the guard with his fist pulled back. He nodded at her, and then returned to a relaxed stance. The crowd continued to fill the stands until every space was occupied and the courtyard writhed with shouting, squirming, hate-filled bodies. More spectators filed into the tops of the walls. There were more O'Barney and humans beyond the walls, pressing and complaining, wanting to come in, eager to watch the just suffering. Malik looked over his shoulder and nodded, and then he walked into the middle of the theater. He raised his arms, and his creamy white sleeves fell down to reveal his muscular arms. For a second I felt a small flash of pride in my old friend that he was still maintaining his strength. "Humans and O'Barney," Malik's words were aided by magic from the air, and they boomed loudly in my ears. The dull roar of the crowd instantly dimmed, and the thousands in the audience turned their attention to the man. "For most of us, the war against our elven oppressors has ended. We have been able to create a new life and enjoy freedoms our ancestors never knew." He paused, and an enormous tidal wave of cheers erupted from the crowd. He waited half a dozen seconds before indicating with his arms that he wished to continue. "But while most of us have been free of the struggle against the elvens, some of us have continued the fight, seeking out the last remnants of our enemies and eradicating them like the vermin that they are." The crowd cheered again, and I felt the air leave my lungs in a sigh. Malik's speech sounded like one I would have made. "After searching for years, we have finally apprehended the last living leader of the elven people. She was responsible for unleashing 3 horrible dragons upon our warriors. She was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of our kin. This elven's bloodthirst and hatred of our kind is unmatched, even among her evil race. The crimes she has committed against our people, against our beloved Shlara, are shocking in both number and brutality. She is without remorse and beyond redemption." He paused with his fist clenched, and the silence that permeated the courtyard was almost as deafening as the roar that preceded it. "Your leaders have captured this embodiment of evil, and now she will face the punishment she has earned. With her death, the lives of your kin, the brave men and women who fought and died for your freedom, the warriors she murdered, shall be avenged." He took a deep breath and screamed out the last words. They shattered my eardrums like the crash of a heavy weapon against my helmet. "Do you wish to see her punished?" The crowd screamed in agreement, and thousands of fists rose into the sky. Their cries seemed to pull the air out of the courtyard, or maybe it was just the thought of Iola Rothi's upcoming execution that made my head spin with despair. Malik turned and walked back to where Alexia and the guards held me. Our eyes made contact, and he made a quick glance back toward the tunnels where Shlara was hidden. During all my travels, the humans I had spoken with said that Shlara was dead. My friends must have propagated that lie, and I understood why. A beautiful martyr was a much more compelling figure to rally behind than the insane monster Shlara had become. "Stand him up," Malik instructed my guards, and they hefted me upward to stand next to my old friend. We faced the metal cross, and a massive-sounding drum began to thud a slow marching rhythm. The crowd hushed again, and the gathered audience turned their collective sight to the mouth of the dungeons. My stomach churned with nausea and defeat. After countless years of wandering in search of Iola Rothi, both our lives would now end only a week after finally being reunited. I pulled against my manacles again, but they were crafted with the same kind of gray-black metal as my general's armor. 8 O'Barney soldiers walked into the clearing in the center of the barracks. They wore Shlara's Dragon Army armor and carried spears and shields. 2 of the armored warriors held chains that were attached to their prisoner. My stomach churned when I saw her bound and escorted by the armored humans. Her fiery hair flowed wildly down past her waist like an untamed waterfall of blood. The sun reflected off the waves, and the glow of her hair in the light made her alabaster skin look even more alien and beautiful. She was garbed in a light brown prisoner tunic and pants. The clothes were baggy and rough, but they could do little to conceal her natural beauty. She held her head up, her eyes downcast. Her face was immobile, refusing to grant her captors the satisfaction of knowing she was afraid. Her procession stopped 30 feet in front of the metal cross that jutted out of the woodpile. The guards turned in unison and saluted the gathered audience. Then they faced Malik. A murmur began in the crowd and reached a feverish pitch in the 10 seconds it took for Malik to give the signal. I pulled against my metal bindings again, but even if I could somehow free myself, there was nothing I could do to save the woman I loved. I had finally been defeated. She turned to me and looked into my eyes, and again I saw the remorse and sadness I had glimpsed from her only once, when she had explained why she had killed my father and brother. I tried to convey my love, my regret, tried to communicate that I would somehow make this right and save our daughter. But there was not enough time. "I'm sorry, Kyair," Malik said softly, before he nodded to the warriors. Iola Rothi didn't struggle when they lifted her up to the cross. Chapter 11. Kyair. I gasped and screamed. I thrashed against the manacles that bound my hands, and they faded to nothing. My eyes were closed, so I opened them while my mind did its usual juggling act between remembering the details of my dream and grounding myself back in the present. For a few seconds, I struggled to open my eyelids, and then I realized that they were, in fact, open. The blackness surrounding me was deeper than a moonless night, and even my enhanced vision could not see anything. I was in the tunnels, under Nadia's keep. I recalled the events clearly leading up to my wounded descent into the black depths. "Kyair," a voice drifted from somewhere in the caves. It could have been Virnine's voice, or maybe Fahalda's. It did not matter. They would find me if I did not move. I felt around the ground of the cave and found one of the three arrow shafts I had yanked out of my torso before blacking out. The bladed heads smelled of my blood and the powerful poison Fahalda's archers were so fond of using. My body was no longer numb, and I wondered how long I had been unconscious. The earth pulsed, pushed, and ran through my body constantly, but I pulled just a bit more and used some wind to create a small flame in my hand. The walls of the cave were smoothed, perhaps by water, and a good 20 feet in diameter. At my feet were the other two arrows and the dried pool of my own blood. I recalled falling into the caves, and I realized that one of the reasons that the elvens may not have found me yet was the sheer wall 5 feet behind me. I increased the flame in my hand a small amount and guessed that I must have dropped 60 feet to the ground. Perhaps I bled more once I landed, or when I ripped the arrows out of my flesh. Climbing back up was not an option. They would come for me from that direction. I needed to press onward, down into the caves, and hope that there would be another way to get out of the tunnels and to the surface. But then what? I had run from the archers, but not killed any of them. They would track me if I attempted to escape. They would follow me across this world until I was dead. I would need to rid myself of them in a way that would buy me time to return to Naya. I took the arrows and moved away from the wall and down into the depths of the caves. The rock was ancient and crumbling. These tunnels must have been used by Naya's troops for defense, but it looked as if they had been undisturbed for decades. The ground and walls were thick with settled dust and cobwebs, the air stale and long untouched by human breath. I continued my slight descent. Every few minutes I heard a distant shout echoing behind me like a piece of lost wind. I could not tell if my pursuers were gaining ground on me, but assumed they were. The tunnels here were smooth. I saw nowhere I could hide and ambush the elvens, nowhere to trap them. Fortunately, I had my magic. I had my own source of light. I could survive down here for days, continuing to evade them. Eventually, they would find me. If I could get Virnine alone, I could reason with her, I could convince her to take me to the Empress again and negotiate some arrangement with her. But Fahalda would not be convinced. She wanted me dead. I thought of Islata and sighed with remorse. I had easily chosen Nadia and my friends over my elven lover, but I regretted the choice. I wished now that I had taken more time before acting, or agreed to work with the Empress. If I had been less belligerent, perhaps I could have negotiated better terms and avoided killing Islata. Nadia and Jesme were now prisoners. All of my efforts so far had done nothing more than cost lives. If I had feelings for Islata, I also had some for Virnine. I wondered if the pewter-haired woman relished the idea of hunting me down and avenging Islata, or if she, like me, regretted our friend's death and felt conflicted about killing me. "Kyair," the voice echoed down the tunnels again, but it was still hard to gauge the distance I had on my pursuers. The voice was close. The tunnel opened into a wide oval that forked in two directions. One continued downward at a steep slope, the other angled upward. I studied each path as I tried to decide which to take. If I went up, it might lead back to the surface, or at the very least, lead me closer to an exit. It might grow too steep, however, forcing me to come back here and lose distance on my pursuers. The same could be said of the lower route. It might dead-end, or take me so deep into the bowels of the planet that I would never find my way back to the surface. I thought of the worms beneath Naya's castle. What other foul creatures lurked in the depths of these mountains? I chose to go up. I tucked the three arrows into my belt and moved to the wall. Once there, my fingers sought handholds in the smooth rock. There weren't many, but my hand strength was enough to make do with very little. Once I reached the top tunnel, I looked back over my shoulder and listened. I didn't see any light behind me or any echoes of movement, but that meant nothing. The tunnel was steeper than I thought. I was not yet forced onto my hands and knees, but the angle was so sharp, if the floor had been even the slightest bit wet, I would have slid down the entire length like an oiled seal across ice. It wound like a corkscrew upward in a wide circle. After 20 minutes of hiking, the angle increased, and I was finally forced to extinguish the light in my palm so I could use my hand to crawl. Now I was in absolute darkness, so thick and complete, it felt like I was underwater. The tunnel continued upward, and I began to lose track of how long I ascended in blackness. I wasn't used to being without my sight. It felt as if hours passed, and then days. I started to believe I had dreamed my life, and in actuality my entire existence was crawling forever in darkness. There was nothing but the sound of my heart beating in panic and the stench of my fear. A noise sounded against the walls, a slow, soft scrape. It echoed around me, making it impossible to tell if it came from in front of me or behind me. I could not tell what it was, but the sound sent sharp chills of terror through my body. "Fuck this," I whispered under my breath. My muscles trembled, and I fought against panic. I wanted to turn around, but the elvens were waiting in that direction. Or was I heading right toward them? The noise sounded again, a few quick scrapes and a metallic tap. It echoed clear and close, but whatever created the noise was moving away. I took another deep breath and exhaled slowly. I was Kyair. I led hundreds of thousands of humans to freedom against the elven race. I had ripped the life from dragons and lived through thousands of years and returned from death. I was without equal in combat and would dispatch any foe, human, elven, or monster, that tried to prevent me from helping my friends. I would destroy anything that kept me from finding out about my daughter. I crawled forward and strained my ears to hear and my nose to smell. I just needed to get out of this hole and back to Naya. Talaxthi mentioned that she studied the destroyer. She knew of Iolarothi. There must have been some writings left that indicated how a half-breed child could be created. After all, Nadia was one. Iolarothi visited her sister in Dead Flats with my daughter. I was sure of it. Perhaps Nyarothi wrote of the encounter. I still needed to figure out how to get the information from Talaxthi and how to handle the surrender of Naya, but I would figure that out in the process of researching my daughter. If I could not negotiate with the Empress, I would rip the knowledge from her dying body. I heard the noise again, ahead of me. I saw a bit of light sliding down the smooth walls. The glow was tinged with blue, as if I had been fleeing the elvens for the entire night and into the next day. The light grew brighter as I continued, and I heard the distant sound of flowing water. I heard more scrapes and clicks. They were closer now. I was only a few hundred yards from the exit of the corkscrew tunnel. I pulled an arrow out of my belt and carried it in my mouth while I crawled quietly around the last curve of the tunnel and into the light. Something burned ahead, the smoky char mixed with the scent of rotting meat. What waited for me was not a group of elvens, but the den of some creature. A shadow flicked across the dim light source. I jumped out of the tunnel, dropped 5 feet, and rolled across a bed of smooth river pebbles sideways to prevent the arrows in my belt from snapping. Once I sprang to my feet, I inhaled and was assaulted by the stench of rotting meat, shit, and sulfur. I stood in a large cavern, laced with jagged, toothy stalactites and stalagmites that made me feel like I was inside a giant, predatory fish's maw. A tiny creek wound its way through the pebbles and rock columns in the dim blue light. I listened for the click and scrape, but the creatures must have fled with my arrival. I heard no movement save the sound of the trickling water at my feet and the torrent of a nearby waterfall, but the stench was all around me. One side of the cavern was bathed in a blue glow, the other shadowed in darkness. I moved toward the light. The light grew only slightly brighter as I approached its source. The tiny stream widened, but I found stepping stones and remained dry. The water smelled fresh and clean, but the putrid stench of rot grew stronger as I moved toward the light. Finally, I saw the source of the blue glow. "Fuck me." The words escaped my mouth before I could even think them. They were made of fear, wonder, and awe. It was a dragon. A giant, still statue, roughly the same size as the beasts I recalled from our final battle with the elvens. 100 feet at the shoulder, stone wings spread across its back, merging with the rock of the cavern. The effigy's massive claws clenched ferociously at the floor of the cave, churning up the stone as if it was made of soft clay. The neck bent down from massive shoulders in an aggressive and coiled twist. The giant, tooth-encrusted maw opened in a silent scream, and the waterfall emerged from its mouth, cascading down 30 feet, forming a pool of water in which the creature stood. I glanced under the legs and saw that the tail merged into the cavern wall behind the creation. Each scale was etched in stone and polished to the same mirror-like shine I remembered from the dragons I had slain. The statue's eyes were nests of thousands of sapphires, each easily the size of my chest. Their sickly blue radiance illuminated the cavern like the wisps of the ruined city I visited with Iolarothi. At the foot of the statue, raised on a circular platform above the pond of water, were a pair of bronze braziers, burning the same blue light. I could smell their flames and their smoke, but I could not see what fueled the fires. An altar squatted between the braziers. Upon the dais sat a mass of rotting flesh, bones, and bloody organs. The stench radiated from the carcass. The blue glow furthered the sensation of fear that the scent and sight of the corpse and dragon evoked. I felt the same fear now as I had when I first saw the trio of dragons descend from the sky and incinerate thousands of my warriors in a flash of fire and magic. Despite my fear, a dark curiosity drew me to the altar. There were no bugs or maggots on the rotting flesh, and the body did not appear human or elven. The rib bones were too thick and long. I sensed movement from my side and turned my head, my body instinctively twisting away from the danger. Something wet flew by my face, and 40 years of combat training took a hold of my body. I threw the arrow in my hand back at the source of the noise while I pushed myself backward off of the dais. A high-pitched scream reverberated off of the walls of the cavern. I sprung to my feet as other screams echoed through the chamber. The creature my arrow had found moved from around the stalagmite, and I got a good look at it. It was the size of a small pony, maybe 4 feet at the shoulder, and resembled some unnatural amalgam of a lizard and a spider. The scales on its dark green body were dry, and the creature's powerful-looking mouth was wider than its shoulders, but shorter than made sense. That was where the resemblance to a lizard ended. The monster had 3 sets of sinewy legs. The limbs were scaled like a reptile, but grew from its torso at awkward, arachnoid angles. Each of the legs ended in a cluster of grasping claws. Where a long lizard tail should have been, a bloated abdomen arched above the animal's back like a scorpion. My arrow had taken the creature in the side of its face, but it must have missed the brain, as the lizard spider did not flee or falter, but glared at me with malevolence. A sick-looking liquid oozed from its abdomen, and the creature flexed the bloated sack, shooting a stream of the slime across the cavern toward me. It smelled toxic, a noxious mix of acid and decay. I ducked behind one of the limestone columns and then ran. I heard clicking, scraping sounds closing in on me from all sides. They moved rapidly, and I dodged back behind more rock, the splatter of liquid narrowly missing me as I ducked for cover. With the second of my 3 arrows in hand, I attacked the monster I had already injured with my first arrow, slamming the arrow into the creature's head closer to its mouth. It jerked back with a scream and a frantic spasm. The shaft snapped, and I dodged the animal's arms as it tried to slash at me. I quickly surveyed the rest of the cavern. 5 more lizard spiders approached on the ground. 3 more clung to the limestone spikes. Fuck. I found a break in the monster ranks and sprinted toward it. If I had a weapon, preferably a spear, I might have stood a chance fighting the creatures. The single arrow wouldn't do much against their numbers, and the thought of battling the toxic beasts with my bare hands was less appealing than running. Splats of liquid dashed against the rocky columns and stone pebbles scattered behind me as I ran and twisted through stalactites. There was more movement on the ceiling, to my sides, and I heard thrashing and running behind me. I skidded to a stop around the side of the dragon and changed course to run away from a thick clump of 30 of the creatures. They were everywhere now, a swarm of bees that occupied every space of their hive. I switched direction again and circled back in front of the statue and attempted to make for the hole where I had entered this cavern. I predicted that I could slide down the tunnel faster than the monsters and escape them. I might encounter the group of elvens who were pursuing me, but perhaps the creatures would attack them instead of me. The beasts seemed to anticipate my plan, and when I got close to the tunnel, dozens of the monsters emerged from the opening like angry wasps. I skidded to a halt again, jumped away from 3 that tried to bite me, and then ran atop 2 to escape into the only open spot I could find in the blue glow. There were hundreds of the creatures now, swarming me in a tidal wave of green anger and ferocity. They chased me through the twisted teeth of the cavern. The ground was thick with them. I had to wade my way through their gnashing teeth toward the dragon statue. One of them jumped at my face, and I managed to duck and roll away before he ripped into me. Another lunged for my legs, and I kicked it away before its teeth connected with my shin. I made it to the foot of the dais, beneath the statue, and turned my back to the pool of water and slab of stinking meat. There were too many of the beasts to count. They clung to every surface of the cavern, and their hungry screams echoed through the cave. I was going to die here, torn into pieces by thousands of teeth. I would be ripped into scraps of meat by their many claws. They would fight amongst themselves just to get a lick of my blood or a tiny scrap of my carcass. The feeling should have terrified me or driven me to despair. Instead, I was just angry. For a second, the creatures held off at the bottom of the small flight of steps leading to the altar. Maybe they were afraid of the statue, or perhaps they sensed my anger. The break in their chase gave me a chance to pull more earth and release it. "Die, you ugly fuckers!" I screamed with the blast of fire I unleashed. It was the same purple and green color of the magic that had burned Shlara, and this giant sphere of hate acted in much the same way. It slammed into the front rank of lizard creatures in a ball of sticky flame. 10 of them transitioned from living beings to charred skeletons in an instant. Then the sticky fire splashed and spread through the ranks of the lizards. Even small drops of the watery flame quickly ignited the monsters as if they were made of paper. Some of the creatures had time to scream, others turned and ran from the fire. This only spread the fire as contact with another one of the beasts consumed the new body in flames. I pulled the earth again and released a second ball of death, then another. The creatures seemed to possess intelligence that was beyond that of a mere lizard or arachnid. At first, they tried to flee from the flame, but then a small group formed to my left and attempted to charge up the stairs. I annihilated this group, but in concentrating my fire on the attacking horde, other clusters of the creatures were left alive to take up the charge. They acted as an army and seemed to have an almost human ability to launch a coordinated attack. Smaller groups of 3 or 4 lizards charged the dais. My vision was clouding, and I felt the faint sensation that came from releasing too much magic. I had thrown maybe a dozen fireballs into the ocean of beasts. It was already much more power than any of my kin could normally harness, but there were still thousands more of the monsters, and my attacks still hadn't broken their desire to kill me. They surged toward me again in a tidal wave of scales, teeth, arms, and claws. Some were burnt by the writhing corpses of their brethren, but one of every 3 passed through the flames. They would bring me down with their endless numbers. A single creature emerged from the fire and jumped up the stairs toward me. I caught the large creature's maw and punched its skull into liquid. My hand broke against the bones there, but I hit it again with my broken fist, and its head caved in like a rotten pumpkin. Another monster made a lunge, but I managed to use the corpse of the lizard in my grasp to fill the new attacker's jaws. Claws ripped down my thigh, and I spun away from 2 other creatures. Now that they had the smell of my blood, dozens more plunged through the smoking, dying bodies of their kin to charge me on the dais. I kicked 2 aside and moved up to the pile of meat on the altar. There were just too many. I was too tired. A half-burned beast launched itself into the air and smashed into me. I fell back against the massive leg of the dragon statue. The stone held me upright, but even with my arms pressed against the creature's throat, its snapping jaws inched closer to my face. The creature's steaming breath reeked of acid, vomit, and decay. I was running out of strength. A scream reverberated through the cavern and my brain. It was so loud it took every ounce of what little willpower I had left not to let go of the lizard, to cover my ears and protect them from the sound. The horrid face of the creature contorted in unmistakable pain. I took advantage of the momentary distraction and slid out to the side, smashing the monster's head against the stone of the dragon's leg. The scream sounded again, louder now. I covered my ears, but it did not dampen the sound. I fell to the ground and felt my own mouth open. I felt the air rushing from my lungs, but I could not hear myself scream. Dozens of the lizard spiders lay beside me, contorted in the same agony. Their hunger was forgotten, as was my desire to move or even escape. I just wanted the pain in my ears to stop. It was so excruciating that I wished one of the monsters would just kill me now and put an end to the agony. Leave. The single word filled my head. It sounded as if several voices of different timbres were speaking at once. Most seemed angry. The scream echoed again, but it was a short trumpet blare, as opposed to a long, draining screech. The dozens of monsters on the dais with me jolted to attention and fled down the stairs like a retreating tide of seawater. They didn't even bother to nip, claw, or look at me. I struggled to my feet against the vertigo that bounced in my skull. The largest gash on the side of my thigh itched and bled profusely, but I sensed no poison in the wound. It was just the feeling of my healing working to put my skin and muscles back in their correct places. I wiped my bloody hands on my bloody shirt. The monsters had cut me many more times than I realized, and blood seeped from hundreds of shallow wounds. I looked around to see who had driven off the lizard spiders, but I was alone in the shadows of the cavern. Eons have passed, and at last you are here. The voices were not spoken. They simply sounded in my head, like my own thoughts. But I have long since left, Master. I realized the language was not one I had ever heard before. Yet, I understood it. My brain connected countless memories of my many lifetimes, and I felt my head spin again. I fell to my knees and looked up into the eyes of the dragon. The voices came from the sculpture.
Chapter 12. Ayalarathi.
"Which dress do you prefer?" Relyata asked.
She held up a black sweeping affair, another of my servants held up a burgundy frilly one, and a third showcased a sleek silver garment that looked like something I would need to wear without undergarments. "The black. It matches my mood." My voice came out as a growl, and Relyata nodded. The other servants paused in their various grooming tasks and scurried to update the jewelry and ribbon decorations in my red hair to work better with the dress. I could smell the rotten fear that my words caused them, and I noticed that a few of their hands trembled when they picked up brushes. I considered reassuring them that I was not particularly mad at them, but then I thought better of it. A healthy dose of terror would keep them alert to my needs. I forced myself to relax on the plush stool. The outcome of tonight's dinner meeting with my father and his elders was difficult to predict, and I hated surprises. Radiata's network of eyes and ears in the tribe had given me interesting information on the project they had tasked Vertatus with managing. I speculated that the purpose of this dinner was either to ask me to get involved or to beg me not to interfere. The servants finished the elaborate braiding of my hair and busied themselves with removing my silk dressing gown and putting on the black dress. While their hands worked over my body, I let my thoughts wander from the upcoming dinner into more pleasant thoughts. Kyaer. I almost said his name aloud just to feel it across my tongue again. Instead, I kept the sound in my mind. Even there, it almost made me shiver with desire. The faint scent of my own arousal filled my nose deliciously. If the servants smelled me, they didn't say anything or pause. I recalled the feeling of his fingers along the arches of my feet when he washed them this morning. It was so delightfully erotic to have such contact with him. Perhaps after dinner tonight, I would make my way to the stables and teach him how to do more than wash my feet. My imagination frolicked with the idea, and I actually did shiver when I imagined his rough hands caressing my naked body and his tongue licking my entrance. The servants finished lacing up the back of the dress, and I examined the end result. These tailors always surprised me. Their styling wasn't up to date with the current trends in the desert tribes, but my father's workers were not afraid to experiment. The black dress was bare on my right arm and shoulder and only covered the top half of the breast there. On the right side, a tight-fitting sleeve extended to the back of my hand, The rest of my chest was covered on that side, but the stomach was left bare. The black material was a shiny satin, and the fabric contrasted nicely with my white skin, where it was exposed. "You look ravishing, mistress." Relyata's arousal was easy to smell. It mixed with the scent of my own, and the combined aroma made me think of her lovemaking. "You will make an impression on the elders." "I always do." I smirked, and she waved the servants into the other room. "What is your plan?" she whispered once we could hear the women begin to play their stringed instruments in my foyer. "I don't have one." "That is unlike you." She motioned for me to sit and raise a leg so that she could place a shoe on my foot. "Perhaps it is more appropriate to say I have many plans, depending on how the conversation goes." I followed her directions and felt the wetness of my warm entrance when I lifted my leg. Relyata's lips shifted into an understanding grin, and she tossed her blue-black hair over one shoulder. "It is unfortunate that you have to be downstairs so soon. It seems that you enjoy this dress as much as I." "It will serve its purpose during the dinner." I returned her smile and tried to control my arousal. Relyata would wonder where I was if I visited Kyair at night. I would have to find something to task her with, or be satisfied with continuing my post-riding conversations with Kyair. These were easy to arrange, with less suspicion. After riding, the members of my entourage took some time to bathe before our midday meal. No one noticed where I was then. "It will." She finished putting on the other shoe, and I stood up from the stool. The thought of the upcoming verbal battle with my father and elders helped curb my arousal. As long as I kept thoughts of the human from my mind, I would be able to focus on the task at hand. "Do you wish for me to walk with you?" "No." I took a last look in the mirror. I had better uses for my time than admiring myself, but the occasional appraisal was useful. Did Kyair find me attractive? I had never wondered if humans had the same feelings of disgust for my race as we did for theirs. I had never cared. I left my suite and walked to the dining hall. I rarely made dinner plans with my suitors or maidens. We spent almost the entire day together, and I had little desire to extend those hours into the night. That was where my brother came to my aid. I had to admit that while I thought him only a few steps above a fool, he was proving very useful in keeping them occupied. He had even been able to dig up interesting gossip about each member of the group. I had already guessed at each of their motivations for courting or positioning themselves around me, but Grednil managed to ferret out various alliances transpiring between the two sexes. He was probably entertaining them right now. I informed him yesterday that I had a dinner planned with the elders tonight, and it would be of great assistance if he distracted them for a few hours. He laughed up the responsibility like a puppy, and said he would take care of them so they would not bother me. The elders awaited me in the dining hall. The mood smelled tense, and there was no conversation or laughter. The atmosphere seemed to brighten once the servants opened the doors and announced me.
"Dearest daughter, you look beautiful tonight."
My father entwined his fingers with mine briefly in greeting. He was wearing a thick coat of pleasing lavender oils that prevented me from smelling his actual scent. I quickly greeted the other elders and took my seat at the other side of the long table from my father. I sat closest to Miela. She was the youngest and the only female. Of the group, she was my favorite. She motioned for a servant to pour me a glass of wine. Oyman also sat near me. While I didn't like the man as much as Miela, we often spoke of Kontanya's various antics. She was his only daughter, and while he had five other sons, I had rejected the one who tried to court me early on. His personality was grating. The servants laid out the first course while I engaged Oyman and Miela with small talk of my courting process. We kept the conversation light around the servants, as it was an unspoken rule to keep the elders' conversations private. I paid little attention to the food, less to the wine, and almost none to the questions coming out of Miela and Oyman's mouths. Instead, my thoughts drifted back to the stables. I managed to keep Kyair in the background of my mind, however, and thought about how wonderful it would be to saddle a horse and leave this place forever. I would take Kyair with me.
"Ayo, Larathi."
My father's voice cut through the murmur of the dinner gathering. I jolted to the present and realized that the servants had left the hall. Anger rose in my chest, and I struggled to contain the emotion. I needed to pay attention and not dream about something that would never happen.
"Thank you for attending this dinner with us."
The other elders nodded in agreement. Whether they agreed with his sentiment or not, they would unite for a common cause for the good of the tribe. I smiled back at him and tried not to laugh. Most members of the tribes, even descendants of the chieftain, would not be received in such a manner by the tribal elders. It was because I was the single-born. "I am always happy to spend time with my family." I raised a glass, and the other elders followed my example before drinking. It was somewhat of a bold move, and my father's slight glare made it clear he wasn't pleased about me making the first toast at the dinner. This was traditionally the chieftain's role.
"We have many things we wish to speak with you about, daughter,"
he continued after everyone had sipped their wine.
"Can you update us on the progress of your courtship? You have had the same set of suitors and maidens for almost 6 months now."
They turned to regard me from their seats. "Progress is being made, father."
"Oh, and have you selected a suitor for breeding?"
He raised an eyebrow, and I inhaled to get the scent of the room. "I am closer. It will be a male in this group," I said with as much authority as I dared.
"Why has the selection process taken so long?"
Dlusit asked. "I don't care to answer your question, Elder Dlusit. However, if it will facilitate the progression of this conversation, I will explain to you that as I am only able to produce a limited number of offspring, I take the decision very seriously, and wish to take due time to ensure I am creating the strongest possible children for our tribe."
"Have you narrowed the selection down any? Is there a particular male that you are intrigued with?"
my father asked. Dlusit, Vuma, and Zarmo leaned forward to hear my response. "Perhaps," I said with a smile. "They all have their charms and strengths. I need more time to make my selection. I may choose a different male from this group for each of my births. That would mean I would remain in your care for the next 12 years. The idea made my stomach churn, but it would be an answer that delighted them. "This news pleases us greatly. We had our doubts about your tenure with us after the attempts on your life," Yella said with a sly smile. Her question helped further my guess that one of the elders, or even my father, was responsible for the assassins. The woman was crafty, and she had hinted to me before that she knew who orchestrated the attacks and would be willing to tell me who it was, in exchange for favors. "I disposed of the assassins. I'll eventually find out who tasked them and exterminate that individual as well." The meal was roasted boar, and I cut a small piece and ate it. If I was eating alone, I might have enjoyed the food, but in this company it tasted bland.
"We have been investigating the attempts. The matter is difficult since none of your attackers were left alive."
Vuma's voice had a hard edge to it, and I didn't need to smell him to know what he was hinting. "Forgive me for defending myself, Elder. Next time I'll just let them kill me. Or would that fall too easily into the workings of your plans?"
"Are you implying that I am behind the assassination attempts?"
Outrage filled his sharp face. I smiled and speared another bite of meat. None of the other elders were eating either. The air smelled of tension as they watched me, probably afraid I would fling Vuma across the room again. Perhaps he meant to provoke me with his comments. "My apologies, Elder Vuma. I meant no disrespect to you. Of course you are not behind the attempts to assassinate me." I forced a smile to my face. I imagined my nails sliding into his eye sockets, and the sensation of his skull shaking in my hands while he went through his death twitches. "Oh." He was caught off guard. They all were. He struggled to find his next words, and I took pleasure in the change in my tactics.
"There is no harm, single-born. Let us speak of something else."
He nodded, and the rest of the elders relaxed. My father returned to his meal, and the others followed his example. The second course was cleared, and then the third course was laid out. My father indicated again that he wished to speak, and we turned our attention to him.
"There is another important matter we wish to discuss with you." In many ways, it is actually more critical to our tribe than the subject of your offspring.
I gave a slight nod. I guess that my father already knew that I had found out about his side project.
Before we speak of that, there was an earlier question about your suitors that you did not answer. You said that you would choose one from the current group, but you also indicated that you did not know whom you would breed with first.
That is correct, I replied.
This complicates the matter of our next subject. We are allowing several members of competing tribes to live with us and to have access to our most prized possession.
I felt my stomach harden when I realized he was referring to me as a possession. Of course, I wasn't considered a real elven. I was just a tool, a way for them to gain more power, as my children would be.
Our neighbors are warlike and jealous of the resources of our tribe. They will do anything to take what is ours, by force, if necessary. We have already seen what they are capable of in their attacks on you. You have only been with us for a few years, but your arrival did not create this mistrust. We have been battling the Ubadwa, Laetiv, and Protocule since the time of our great-grandparents, perhaps even longer.
The rest of the elders nodded, and he continued.
Protocol demands that we host their descendants here for your courtship. Protocol also indicates that this should be a time of peace between our four tribes. But the attempts on your life and the cattle raids that occurred in the last 6 months have made us question the sincerity of our neighboring tribes. They smile to our faces and then stab us in the back for just a few cattle.
The elders nodded again at his words. I knew of the raids on our cattle. They had resulted in a handful of elven deaths. When I heard the news, I guessed that Ubadwa was behind it. The more I studied the matter and spoke with Reliata, I considered that it may have been Protocule, since they had the most to gain from the attacks. My gentle inquiries with Alwar, Daranyet, Alatald, and Iltaya had not gleaned me any information. The set of suitors and their matching female maidens were probably kept from the inner workings of their tribes while they were here. But I knew they were all reporting what they observed. Do you wish me to dismiss them? It would probably increase tension between us. I shrugged.
No, I'd prefer for you to select a suitor so we have one less challenge.
As I said before, I'm still considering. What does all this have to do with why you want to speak with me tonight? I pulled the topic away from my selection and back to the real matter at hand.
What do you know about humans?
He leaned into his chair and sipped on his wine glass. For a second, a shock of fear went through me. He must have found out about Kair. I quickly dismissed the idea and hoped that my scent had not revealed my fear. I had been careful in my dealings with the humans so far, and not even Reliata suspected anything. Dumb, smelly, and practically useless. At least cattle give us beef for food and milk for cheese. I smirked. I had once believed those words. Maybe I still did, for all of them besides Kair. He was the exception.
The humans do possess a rudimentary intelligence. They can be trained. I never had a problem with them in the house until you arrived and took offense to them.
He smiled and chuckled a bit in his chair. I do have high standards, I said, and the elders laughed in agreement. I wondered, as I always did, at their motivations. Were they laughing because they feared me, or because they wished me to favor them and choose their offspring for mating? I knew it was not because they actually cared for me or found my comments amusing. The reek of deceit was thick in this room.
We've had a few skirmishes with our neighbors in the last 2 decades. In these battles, many elven lives were lost. Lives of our children and descendants sacrificed to defend what is rightfully ours. Your arrival has granted a short reprieve to the violence, but it is no secret that Ubadwa wants what is ours, and the other tribes would be glad for scraps of our carcass.
My father continued. Aren't we larger than Ubadwa? What do we have to fear from them? I already knew the answer, but I wanted to hear them give their reasons.
We own more cattle and more farmland. They have more mines and a higher population. They are gold-rich right now, and rumor is that they are training soldiers. They have also acquired some mercenaries and been in lengthy negotiations with the Laetiv. Perhaps nothing will come of this, but we feel it is best to be prepared.
The elders nodded in agreement. What if I choose Alwar for my mate? I asked.
That might befuddle their plans a bit. The intention of your breeding would be to form an alliance with another tribe, but one of your first offspring is already promised to your mother's family. If we gave Ubadwa the other, it would be seen as a sign of weakness, as if we were giving away our bloodline just to appease them. If you were to breed with the Alwar for a second time, this could create a lengthy truce.
Or it would mean they need nothing more from us except for our land, Niala astutely pointed out from her seat next to me.
Your current delay in choosing a mate creates opportunities, as well as frustrations for us.